Afternoon's meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 1:35 on Saturday, April 13th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representatives Jackson, Klayman, Drummond, Zolkowski co-chair, Pruitt, and myself, Representative Sponholz co-chair. The record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment, if you can, to silence your cell phones during the duration of this meeting. Thank you. I also want to just acknowledge that Representative Sarah Hannon is in the room as well. Before we move into our hearing today, I want to thank Butch Carver from House Secretary from Records and Taylor Kelly from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee, as well as Ted Madsen, our committee aide. So today we just have one item on the agenda. This is the initial hearing for the Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Designee Adam Crum. It's our intention to hear opening remarks from the commissioner, allow the committee to ask questions, and then go to public testimony. We'll hold public testimony open and then return to this confirmation during Tuesday's regular hearing. All right, and now we'll ask Commissioner Crum to come on up. Thank you for coming in on a Saturday. I understand that you've had some travel this week, so I appreciate your flexibility with us. If you can put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Adam Crum, the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you to the committee for the opportunity to be in front of you today. I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself, my education and work history, introduce you to my team, my vision for the department, and then be happy to take any of your questions. I was born and raised in Alaska, one of five siblings. I grew up in a cabin in Anchor Point on the Kenai Peninsula. For a couple of years, we had no running water, and we had to collect our drinking water from a spring. Our family joke is that we had an upscale Anchor Point house because we had an indoor porta potty. Mine was a youth spent hunting and fishing along the banks of the Anchor River, going for halibut and clams in Kashmak Bay. I graduated from Homer High School as a valedictorian, and being no stranger to a challenge, I wanted to see if a small town Alaskan kid could thrive in the Big Ten Conference. So I attended Northwestern University and I joined the football team as a walk-on. Within a year, I had earned a full ride scholarship and actually ended up starting for 2 years. Then I finished by winning a Leadership and Spirit Award as voted on by my teammates and coaches. I completed my time at Northwestern by earning a bachelor's degree in psychology with a focus in pre-med. I tell you about these achievements not to be boastful, but because I want you to know that assuming leadership, pursuing excellence, and taking on challenges is central to who I am. After college, I returned home to Alaska, started working as a safety professional and trainer on projects throughout the state. This brought me all over the state. I have been most of the oil sites in the North Slope, all across Arctic villages, and up and down west coast of Alaska. I spent weeks at a time in Kaktovik, Ukiavik, and Point Hope, which was a great introduction and opportunity to see village life firsthand. I spent a couple years doing this, and then to further my career, I pursued an advanced degree. I was blessed and honored to earn a Master of Science in Public Health from Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health, which is widely held in regards as the number one public health school in the world, where the motto is protecting health, saving lives, millions at a time. To work with such dedicated professionals tackling complex health issues the world over was very humbling and an experience I will always cherish. Some of the subjects studied were public health toxicology, environmental and occupational health law, risk communication and public policy, and epidemiology. I used this knowledge to write white papers on naturally occurring asbestos in western Alaska and about mercury content and its presence and danger in seafood caught in the North Pacific. Having this diverse educational and professional background allowed me to work as a consultant and project lead for large oil and gas companies, pipeline companies, and transportation companies. Some of the work performed would be environmental health analysis on existing and potential projects, long-term strategy, and organizational development. While working with these great companies, I was able to experience firsthand what success looks like from an organizational standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, and from a leadership standpoint. And I have been able to internalize that and use it in my work for other clients and the community organizations I'm involved in. Out of this strategy work was the need to directly influence organizational culture. So I developed a repertoire of leadership courses that I could offer my clients. Are you familiar with Stephen Covey, 7 Habits of Highly Successful People? That's an example of a program I'm certified to facilitate. From a civic perspective, my parents always encouraged us to be active and look for community service projects to take part in. For a number of years, I have been an active supporter of a group called My House, Its goal is to provide educational services, housing, and opportunities to homeless youth in the Mat-Su. Another group I support and participate with is Joy International, a group that brings awareness and raises funds to stop sex trafficking. I've also been honored to serve on the advisory board for the Salvation Army in the Mat-Su, where we try to tackle issues like hungry families, drug treatment and rehabilitation, and transitional housing. In working with these groups and studying these issues they face and what resources are available, I came upon the State Ombudsman's report in May 2018 in regards to an investigation of the Division of Public Assistance. Essentially, it detailed since 2016 there have been hundreds of complaints from individuals about lack of communication, backlog of applications, and delayed payments. And I found the report to be heartbreaking. We have people reaching out in their moment of need, and they weren't being responded to, and that hurts. But on the other side, we have employees that are trying to do the best they can, but they aren't provided the necessary tools or resources to do the to provide the best customer service possible. It occurred to me that what they really needed was leadership and support. It was then that I really started thinking about what I could bring to the role. I bring organizational and strategic expertise and a history of developing high-performing teams and a winning culture. I also bring compassion. I have worked with a lot of the constituent groups that DHSS serves, and I bring a commitment to recognize and support the employees within the department so they can provide the best possible service to those in need. I believe I've been successful in starting down this path. I have been in the role for about 4 months, and I've assembled an excellent team. Deputy Commissioner Albert Wall previously worked within the department, not only as a budget director, but also as the director of behavioral health. He is a military veteran, still active in the National Guard, and has over 20 years' experience as a behavioral health clinician. He spent the past couple years as CEO of Peninsula Community Health Services, and he now oversees what we call family, community, and integrated services. Deputy Commissioner Wall brings a diverse yet relevant background of experience to the expertise to the role, but he also brings a high level of energy. Having worked on that side, seen the longstanding issues, he's motivated to address them for the benefit of all Alaskans. The Deputy Commissioner of Medicaid and Healthcare Policy is Donna Stewart. She's uniquely suited to this role, having spent the previous few years working as the Executive Director of the Office of Rate Review, so she sees all the numbers that come in. Additionally, Donna worked in the Division of Healthcare Services and for the Tribal Healthcare Program in the Commissioner's Office. Before that, she worked as a research analyst for the Washington State Legislature, and even better, she worked at CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as Associate Regional Administrator for the Medicare side. She has vast experience working with and for our federal partners, and she understands the actual numbers as they stand in Alaska. So having her on board is an invaluable resource to me. I'm also happy to have Santa Eford as Assistant Commissioner. Santa returns to the department after having been Deputy Commissioner at Education, but we're lucky to have her as she was previously held this current role from 2012 to 2016. Her knowledge of the department budget will be a great resource going forward. I'd also like to introduce Dr. Lily Liu as our Chief Medical Officer. So she's in Anchorage today, but Dr. Liu came highly recommended by outgoing CMO and Commissioner Dr. Jay Butler. Dr. Liu is board certified in neonatal perinatal medicine. She was the chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Providence Alaska Medical Center, as well as executive director of the Children's Hospital in Providence. Her broad expertise and vast medical research background make her a great asset for the department and state. Another face you probably recognize is Tony Newman, our legislative liaison. I am honored that Tony wanted to stay and work with me. As you know, he's incredibly responsive to all legislative requests, and he's a great representative for the department. Another key person on my team is Heather Carpenter. She came to the department after having worked in the state senate for the past 6 years, but I am lucky to have her as my healthcare policy advisor for her knowledge on healthcare issues as well as insight into the legislative process. Heather was integral to the collaborative process that led to the bipartisan support and passage of 2016 of SB 74, the Medicaid Reform Bill. I didn't allow Heather to come in today so she could spend this beautiful day with her new baby, so we can all envy her. The short time I've been in this role, I have made a focus of reaching out to and visiting as many employees as possible. My first communication as commissioner was to thank everyone for their hard work and for their service, and to always remember the good that they do. This department is large and has many divisions, and it's always a good bet that at least one division may make the news on a weekly basis. So I wanted to make sure all the employees know that as their commissioner, I understand and appreciate the jobs they do, and I'm proud to work with them these difficult times because of the critical nature of their work. I have three top priorities for the department. Number one is addressing the overall budget. We have one of the largest budgets in government, and I'd like to recognize the work you as a committee put into examining our budget and I appreciate your thoughtful consideration and look forward to continue working with you on this complex issue. Going forward, we will address our budget by doing what we can to reduce duplicative efforts, gain efficiencies, and leverage community partners. One such example, in recognition to the burden that the 72-hour rule was to providers, we adopted the American Medical Association's model of 14 days for contemporaneous reporting for physicians. This change will save our providers money and administrative hassle, as well as reduce the possibility of Medicaid being billed for multiple changes in diagnoses. The department is moving forward on how we can amend the 72-hour rule for the rest of the provider types. The second priority is to work on API and its issues. As the only residential psychiatric treatment hospital in Alaska, API plays a critical role in our whole continuum of care for behavioral health. For far too long, API hasn't received its due attention, and this administration is committed to putting API on the correct course to provide better patient outcomes while ensuring the safest environment possible for both patients and for staff. Since taking over this role, we have started addressing the issues at API and have had many successes, such as maintaining certification from CMS and the ability to obtain federal funding, and successful reviews and maintenance of accreditation from the Joint Commission based upon the submission of evidence of standards of compliance on March 8, 2019 and April 1, 2019. It is important to get API back on firm ground in order to then turn our focus to the rest of the behavioral health continuum of care. The third priority is to reduce the backlog of applications at DPA, as I mentioned earlier. We have inserted new leadership at DPA with a renewed focus on tackling the backlog issue, and I'm proud to say we have worked the backlog down from 13,355 when I started to 5,257 as of Friday. In an effort to reduce the backlog and better serve the public, the Division of Public Assistance recently launched an outstationing project of 5 staff at the Alaska Native Medical Center on April 2nd. Our partners at ANMC and ANTHC are grateful for this partnership. This will help individuals determine if they are eligible for benefits more quickly, which is very important when they are seeking health care at the hospital. Other key items that we are working to address are IT or technological solutions, and that can not only remove burden from frontline workers' jobs, but allow them to do it better and faster. We are constantly looking at ways to gain efficiencies while keeping an eye on superior customer service. For instance, during a visit to the Matsu Division of Public Assistance Office, I sat in a room. I saw a room that was 1,400 square feet filled with filing cabinets and banker's boxes to the ceiling. I had to watch 3 employees manually dig through banker's boxes and files, and I just made the offhand comment. I said, "Why don't we have a scanner? Why isn't it scanned?" An employee goes, "Huh," sighed and hung their head. Found out later that because of HIPAA compliance and rules, the department had not invested in a compliant document imaging system. So this is something that we have been working on, trying to push through. So we're working with OYT and the Department of Administration to implement a system that allows our workers to do their job better and faster. It's been an eventful and very busy 4 months for all of us. I want to take a minute to recognize some of the good work that's been underway in our department. Shortly after being named a commissioner, we had the earthquake in South Central, and I got to witness the department at its very best as it implemented a command center and swung into action to make sure the region's health and safety needs were being addressed. Our Tribal Health Programs Unit has had a very successful past few months, exceeding their targets for refinancing Medicaid and developing new initiatives that we believe will likely lead to even more savings in FY20. The department has kept its eye on the prize that is the Section 1115 Behavioral Health Waiver Demonstration Project. This was probably the most complex of the initiatives in 2016 Senate Bill 74 Medicaid reform. We are determined to keep it on track and move Alaska forward toward a more balanced and integrated behavioral health system. A current and exciting initiative on this front is the gap analysis in communities around the state now underway, in which we're meeting with local stakeholders to determine what their needs are. Because we had teams traveling around, we actually put OCS in along with them, so they're going with the Division of Behavioral Health on this gap analysis in order to identify provider capacity and interest for providing prevention services that will be available through the new Family First Prevention Services Act. We continue to take full advantage also of federal grant opportunities that will help us continue to address the opioid epidemic. This is going to include an interdepartmental work between our department, public safety, and corrections. With the good comes the bad. And at the Department of Health and Social Services, we have had our share of challenges since I started as commissioner in December. I'm sure it's no surprise to you that stabilizing Alaska Psychiatric Institute has been a daily focus of my tenure. We are improving at API in many ways in order to improve patient care and both patient and employee safety. First, our certification with CMS has been extended, and we have been accredited for 3 years as of the third of this month. Second, we are increasing staff, including a number of psychiatrists and licensed independent contract or practitioners. We have 16 new nursing applicants thanks to a joint recruitment effort with the university last month, and we believe more will come. Increased staff means increased capacity, and the clinical team made the decision just this weekend to increase capacity to 30 patients. So, and we'll continue to do so as clinically appropriate, because that is fully on their decision. Of course, we still have a long way to go at API. We are still on a provisional license and anticipate a major decision point by CMS before June 30th, but we are seeing improvements and we are on the right track. This week, we had to inform 4,700 senior benefit beneficiaries that we will be unable to pay their payment for May and June. Regulations say that we have to do 10 days notice. When we came upon this issue, we wanted to actually get out in front of this and share this information as soon as possible. I understand and share the legislators' concern for the challenges the shortfall will cause beneficiaries. And you have my commitment that we are working to determine what other options we can make available to the recipients of this program, such as increased SNAP benefits. We have received many questions about why the department took this action. I briefly want to explain that. Statute, regulations, and the prior legislature's fiscal note for HB 236, the bill reauthorizing the program last year, are clear that when appropriations for the Senate benefits program are insufficient to meet the demands for assistance in a fiscal year, the department is directed to reduce or eliminate this cash assistance benefit for that fiscal year, starting with the highest income tier. The department has not requested supplemental funding for this program because of this guidance. Although the prior legislature did provide the department with $20 million in transfer authority across appropriations outside of Medicaid, this happened in 2019. At this time, we do not know what funding can be moved from one program to another without jeopardizing the first program. We have other programs, such as General Relief for Assisted Living Home Residents, which are also short-funded this year. And the department is doing its best working to resolve these shortfalls within the appropriations the programs received. In the case of the General Relief for Assisted Living Home, we've instituted a waitlist for that program to address its shortfall. It is my goal to ensure that on my watch, programs are aligned and managed to ensure their sustainability in the future. I am committed to the department, to the people we serve, and the people I work with. Our mission is to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans, and that's what I'm committed to do. I am humbled that Governor Dunleavy has asked me to perform this role, and I am honored to be before the committee today. Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chairs, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you for those introductory remarks. Are there any questions? Co-Chair Zlokowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner-designee Crum, it's great to finally see you in our committee today. We appreciate your team's years of experience in this work. Many of us have had an opportunity to work with them throughout the last several years, some more than others. But today, our committee is considering your qualifications. Can you talk about what you believe qualifies you to serve as commissioner of one of the state's largest departments with one of the state's largest budgets?
Is it through the chair or is she the chair?
Through the chair.
I apologize. Through the chair. Representative Zlokowski, thank you for that question. So I have spent my professional career working and running our business consulting side. So I have worked with some of the largest companies in the world, and they've been working with me on organization and strategy for how they can operate in Alaska. I speak the language of public health in emergency, and I understand some of these issues. But as I come into this with the strategy and organizational development background, this is the qualifications the governor was looking for. He wanted someone from an outside perspective to come in with a considerate, objective eye to look at what's going on, how do we improve? And this is why I believe I'm qualified for this role. Some of the successes we've already had in the department show that we are on the right track, and the way the team is responding has been tremendous.
Follow up. So we've heard you talk about your experience of coming from a background in a health-related industry, recognizing Johns Hopkins University is not a degree to bat an eye at. It absolutely is a highly regarded medical university. Can you talk about in what professional health or social service related fields you've applied your degrees prior to this particular role?
Oh, thank you for that. So as you know, the department covers a lot of broad stuff, particularly in the public health field, which has emergency, incident command systems, emergency response, And that has been a big part of this. I have been a part, I'm ICS 400 trained. I have been a part of incident commands across Alaska, seeing how these systems work. Just this last week, we had Alaska Shield, which was the raging contagion, which was actually live demonstration throughout the state with multiple communities about how we can transport patients back and forth in the event of a pandemic. So that is one thing I've actually applied my my skills in. The other thing has been working with these companies as far as environmental impact analysis as we deal with community-based items. How do we actually look at epidemiology, population-related data? And that's a big skill set that I've been able to apply throughout my professional career.
Thank you. Follow-up? Mm-hmm. So environmental health, especially from a district like mine, is always something that we find very important because it does impact the health of Alaskans. But the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, as you know, in your months on the job, really focuses on healthcare services, child welfare, public assistance programs, tribal assistance, needy family programs. So can you talk about what your experience in working with those types of programs have been prior to your appointment?
Yeah. It's such a big department that there is no individual who has expertise in everything the department covers. But a lot of the key constituent groups upon which the department serves, I have worked with. Those have been some of these issues with the needy children, dealing with people with, as teenagers that lose homes, they're in transition, they are homeless, trying to find these opportunities. How do we actually work with them? Dealing with hungry families at the Salvation Army, putting together some of these programs and working with them directly. So that's a lot of the expertise that I've worked with directly.
Did you want to follow up? Representative Jackson.
Thank you. Through the chair, so you spoke about volunteering with my house, and I was just wondering if you could share some more about that experience with us.
Through the chair, Representative Jackson, thank you for that question. The My House program is near and dear to my heart because it has been a very eye-opening opportunity as I've been able to work with these youth. These kids that are involved typically in these situations where they've lost home, they have a decision point whether or not they continue with school, and you look at the resources they need. What this group does is it provides what they call a hand up, not a handout. And the goal is to try to give these kids what they need to stabilize them, give them warmth, give them security, and then encourage them to pursue degrees, to pursue training, and to give them resources to grow on. This group also directly works with, and a lot of the key members help set up the Matsu Opioid Task Force as well. And so working with that issue and suicide prevention, and this has been a wonderful opportunity to work with this group. I know that one thing in particular is you look at, and sometimes you associate when someone's in a homelessness situation that it could be a moral failing. And that's sometimes it's easy to see that. But with this group, you've been able to see and work with some of these individuals and these kids that they left home because their parents were in a bad situation and they wanted more for themselves. And when you hear a youth explain that, you just want to pour your heart out for them to give them anything they can to succeed, because these are the people that we want to help. These are the ones that you just want to do anything with to make sure they succeed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. How do you see these types of nonprofits complementing the Department of Health and Social Services? Where, you know, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Jackson, thank you for that. One of the things we're working to do is to maximize our partner groups. How can we actually work with them? Is that co-matching of funds through some of these pilot projects or demonstration projects, we can collect data and find what are the best possible outcomes for these youth. From what we can do in our position here in Juneau or the offices in Anchorage, we're not out in the community, we're not out in the field. It's on these local groups that are the ones who are gonna be successful addressing these homegrown issues. So how can we support them moving forward? And that's one of those things that we work with these groups, we're gonna continue towards.
Thank you.
I just want to note for the record that Representative Tarr called in at 1:42 p.m., so she is listening in, although she may not ask any questions. She said that her connection is not very good. All right. Are there any other questions? Representative Zolkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Designee Crum, it's great to hear you talk about leveraging partnerships. Can you talk about how you, in your capacity as Commissioner of Health and Social Services, would work with tribes throughout Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski, thank you for that. We actually do have scheduled for mid-May continued negotiations for the tribal compacting for OCS. We've had work going on throughout the last year. This is going to be an expansion upon that, about what other work can we work with these tribes to address some of these issues for these vulnerable kids in the villages. We're going to continue to work with them. I'm very happy with our relationship working with the tribal health organizations, particularly ANTHC, through this outstationing project. I believe it was last week or the week before when the staff started, they actually threw a celebration working with them together as we can kind of fight through this backlog together and address these issues faster.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. So to clarify, the meeting that is taking place in mid-May with regard to the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact, which the Tribal Affairs Committee recently heard an update on, is that it is your position to not only continue existing partnerships with tribes in its current form within the compact, but to consider expanding relationships with tribes in the Tribal Child Welfare Compact?
Through the Chair, Rep. Sokoski, yes.
Thank you. Follow-up? Mm-hmm. In the same line of questioning around partnerships, according to analysis that had been done by the other body's Finance Committee, almost 80,000 Alaskans have been covered by Medicaid through both traditional and expansion populations than were covered 4 years ago. Despite this, the state spending has been less in state general funds than we had 4 years ago. So we're essentially covering more Alaskans for less state dollars than we did previously. And no other states have really been able to do that. A large reason why that has been made possible is through the state's partnership with tribal health organizations. Can you talk about how you plan to continue this work with tribes?
Through the Chair, Rep. Sokoski. I'm very excited about the relationship we have. I had the opportunity in Kotzebue to go tour the hospital at Manilik to sit down with their board. I got to see the elder wing they have out there, which is culturally sensitive, and to be able to treat the elders in their home community and region is a tremendous thing. I spent hours with the ANTHC and Alaska Native Medical Center team on a tour going around that facility and seeing that. And we have reached out numerous times. We've had questions about how do they feel about certain programs, and I look forward to continuing that through that important stakeholder group.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. So just to clarify your response then, you are with intention to continue expanding and collaborating partnerships where possible, for example, with tribal health organizations?
Through the Chair, yes, Representative Sokoski. This is as evidenced by this outstationing project for the Division of Public Assistance Eligibility Tax.
Thank you.
I guess I will jump in here and ask a couple of questions. According to your resume, for the last 10 years, you've worked for Northern Industrial Training, which sounds a little bit different than what you described your consulting career. Can you tell us a little bit about that company, the number of employees, the budget that you oversaw, yeah, and how that prepared you to run a $3.2 billion organization with 3,400 staff?
Thank you, Representative, or Madam Chair, I apologize. Yes, so Northern Industrial Training is a company that I own with my family. And at our biggest, we were at 75 employees. And it's known as the truck driving, welding heavy equipment, because that is a lot easier to put on a side of a truck and marketing-wise when you think about it. So the third wing, which was this business consulting side, was the side that I ran, which is primarily out of our Anchorage office, working with these large oil, gas, transportation, and pipeline companies. And that was the side that I worked with on the strategy side, being part of project leads, dealing with these companies, having oversight, putting these planning operations into place and these programs for success of multi-billion dollar projects on their side.
So these were primarily oil and gas companies?
As well as transportation and pipeline.
Transportation and pipeline as well. Okay. So one of the things that you cited in describing your experience and the intersection of your experience with the work that the Department of Health and Social Services does was your volunteer work with the MATSU Salvation Army Advisory Board and the My House Homeless Youth Center. Do you want to describe a little bit more specifically what your volunteer work entailed?
Yeah, through Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we would do is we would actually do mentoring programs. I'd sit down and volunteer with my house. We'd bring students in. We would donate to give scholarships towards individuals so they had a goal to shoot for. Some of these kids coming out of transition, working directly with that, spent a lot of time over there supporting their suicide prevention programs, working with them, trying to find the staff as they grew these individuals and touched these vulnerable population. What could we do to actually help them be even more and grow this program much more robust? So I've been an active participant that way. Through the Matsu Salvation Army, I was on the advisory board, which had to do a lot with planning, fundraising, as well as setting up the expansion of the Matsu Salvation Army unit, which was growing the food bank section, well, food bank's the wrong word, but the storage section food and the pantry. Planning. Food pantry.
Food pantry.
Thank you.
Yeah. So for those of you that don't know, my previous employer before joining the legislature was the Salvation Army, where I worked with the Matsu advisory board amongst other advisory boards in 18 communities across the state. All right, is there any other questions? Representative Clayman.
I just have a question in a couple of areas. As you know from the budget hearings, I've been troubled with the department's willingness to cut state funds and as a process of that, reduce the federal funds that were eligible for under matching dollars under a variety of Medicare and Medicaid programs. Do you have specific plans to continue to try to reduce state dollars that results in the loss of valuable federal dollars in Alaska, or moving forward, can we count on you to be committed to maximizing every federal dollar we can receive through HESS, through the various federal programs?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman. We went through this phase of this process. We had to reduce some reductions, and some of the ways we went about that through cost containment of statute 4707036, the statute requires us to triage our decisions as provider rates, services, and eligibility. And so we went down, we worked that way as some of the issues we can work with while trying to maintain access to primary care. But as we move forward, a lot of the decisions in order to reduce our budget will require our federal partners compliance, and or they have to agree to it for us in order to move forward. So we're going to continue to work on that. And we also wanted to keep an eye on about how much federal dollars and match are we bringing into the state as well.
Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
I'll try to focus the question a little bit more. There's a number of ways in which the House budget, and I know we haven't completely finished the whole legislative budget process, but there were cuts that the department was recommending that the House Finance Committee and this subcommittee didn't agree with, and they had higher levels of state funding. I understand from some of the discussion that the department believes it may have some discretion to not spend money that the legislature believes should be spent to achieve these federal matching funds. Do you expect to not follow the legislature's guidance on spending and spend less than the legislature is appropriating, which will result in the loss of additional federal funds?
Through the chair, mm-hmm. Rep. Clayman. We'll have to continue discussions as we get to that level, sir. I understand a lot of the budget decisions were put back in, and as well as some of the items for the budget reductions for the department required statutory authority. And some of those items have not moved forward at all, so I cannot work against those.
Did you want to follow up on that?
I'm happy if you want to follow up on it.
I guess I want to clarify. I think that Representative Clayman was asking, do you intend to spend less money than the legislature appropriates?
Thank you. As Madam Chair, Representative Clayman.
Appreciate the follow up.
I apologize. That's a new question. Actually, I haven't really thought about that. As we follow the legislative intent, as we'll go through this process, I haven't had any time to ponder that subsect of it.
All right. I think that's a pretty important question. Maybe you can mull it as you think about as we continue through this afternoon. I think Representative Zolkowski has a question.
And do you have a follow-up? Sorry. I appreciate the clarity from the chair. It's my perception, although you may not have thought about it, it's my perception that Ms. Arduin, the budget director, has thought of it extensively and is very anxious. I may be putting words in her mouth, but my impression is that any opportunity she would have to spend less than the legislature indicates we should spend, that she would like you to do that. And I guess my query is, are you going to take your orders from Ms. Arduin, or are you going to be more focused on what the legislature sends on? Because this is an area in which I think there's a number of us would like to answer, although my question was less concise than the chair's. I'd like to know your answer.
Through the chair, Rep. Clayman, I have not been a part of those discussions, and I take my marching orders from the governor as well as statutory and guidance provided by the legislature.
They've got another area I can inquire into, but I'm happy if Representative Zolkowski.
Maybe we can come back around to you. We've got a few people in the queue. So we'll go to Co-Chair Zolkowski first and then Representative Jackson next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Designee Crum, can you describe your level of involvement in a follow-up to Representative Klayman and Representative Sponholz's question? Can you describe your level of involvement in developing the department's proposed FY20 budget?
Through the Chair, Representative Zolkowski. Yes, I was involved in the development of the budget. We worked together to see what were ways we could reduce general fund spending, as well as how can we hit some of these targets as we look towards where we're at in the fiscal situation. As you know, the governor's budget goal was to match expenditures to revenues. And so, yes, I was involved in that process.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. So despite being invited to the testifier table on a couple of occasions throughout the budget subcommittee process, you did not speak on behalf of your department's priorities for the FY20 fiscal year, or you were either not in attendance of the subcommittee hearing. So do you support the budget that was forwarded to the legislature for consideration, which was a reduction in some total amount of roughly $100 million in reductions to Medicaid?
Madam, or through the chair to Representative Sokoski, I'm unsure of what you're referring to because I was at almost every of the budget subcommittees.
So, Commissioner Designee Crum, my question was, do you support the budget that was forwarded to the legislature for consideration for your department?
Through the chair, Representative Sokoski, yes, I do.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. Can you talk then a bit about your position on Medicaid expansion?
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski, we have done nothing in our budget phase to actually address anything when it comes to eligibility. It does bring in a great deal of amount of federal dollars into it, and the system has evolved around that.
Follow up. Under Medicaid expansion, the federal government has borne nearly 97% of health service and administrative costs, providing roughly $1.13 billion to Alaska, while our state spending has totaled just $42.3 million. So, in short, back to Representative Klayman's question, and which is why I wanted to follow up, is Alaska has leveraged roughly $27 in federal funds for every dollar of direct spending, which broadly that amount of federal investment has fueled more than $2 billion in increased economic activity in Alaska, which has generated thousands of jobs and millions of expanded earnings for Alaskans, particularly at a time when we've been in a recession. Are you willing to continue supporting this type of leveraging of funds in order to bring in that amount of federal funding, or would you oppose it for ideological opposition to federal investment in the healthcare industry?
Through the chair, Rep. Zolkowski, we'll continue to support that as we did through our phase one budget. We're not touching eligibility at all. That level of a federal match is very nice for the state.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So your intention is to continue to support Medicaid expansion throughout Alaska under your leadership as the HES commissioner?
Through the chair, Rep. Zolkowski, yes, at this point in time, there have been nothing that changing on that.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Jackson.
Thank you, through the chair. I will work backwards from the question. So one-third of the population here in the state of Alaska depends on Medicaid. Do we have any goals as an administration to help empower people to independence in any way?
Through the chair, Representative Jackson, long-term goal, one of the things that we're working on, this conversation we've had with a number of different senators as well, Madam Chair Sponholz in her office, and with the governors, we want to try to work together to see if we can find something that actually works towards solving the problem of the fiscal cliff. So individuals, as they grow and increase in income, they don't face this binary decision of do they want benefits, yes or no, and so that they can increase their income, and flexibility to do that would be something that we're working towards.
Follow-up? That sounds very inspiring. Thank you for that. Representative Klayman's question, which comes up quite a bit about federal dollars. Well, I'm a little concerned about federal dollars. For one, I think they're in a financial crisis as well. Like, we don't have federal dollars just unlimited. So to not end with the Medicaid expansion. As time goes on, the less we're going to receive from them, and hopefully they have enough to get us however far they can, as promised. But is it a good goal to try to maximize every federal dollar for our state financial sustainability?
Through the chair, Rep. Jackson, as we look at this process with our federal dollars, particularly if we were to do something like the 1115 waivers, they have to be cost neutral or savings for the federal government. So we'd have to work with them that way. Our idea is we want to make sure we've got a sustainable program for Alaska in the future. So more flexibility on how we spend our dollars in state could be a means of doing that as well, because we don't know how the federal government's going to adapt in the future.
I want to recognize that Representative Greyer Hopkins has joined us.
Thank you.
All right. All right, Representative Pruitt, you're up.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. The conversation around this budget has actually kind of interested me. So let me ask you something. You've been in this job, I believe, for about 4 months. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
And during that time, what would you say your average week included? Like, is this a 40-hour a week job? I mean, what does this amount to?
Through the chair, Rep. Pruitt, I actually made the joke this last week to my wife that a 60-hour week would be a nice break. Coming from the entrepreneurial world and having to work and do this, there was a lot of work involved, and this is something that throughout the weekend, as all of you, we have to be available, year-round job. As we go through this process, I've been traveling around. This department covers a lot of different employees on a lot of different locations around the state. I've had the opportunity of going to Fairbanks a couple times to see our facilities and offices there, meet our staff, the Mat-Su facility, some of the Anchorage facilities, meet with some staff out in Kotzebue, here in the Juneau. I believe in just a couple weeks I'll be going to Ketchikan to see some of our facilities there as well. So it's there's travel involved in order to see what we do so I can actually best understand how to support our staff that way. And then the rest of it, there's a lot of time explaining how we're going to go about this, working through the strategy, and empowering our team in order to do so. The way I see this is our department, our mission is to protect and promote the health of Alaskans. But every division has their own specific mission. And it is our job from the commissioner's office to make sure we can support them in order to do that and take care of these vulnerable Alaskans.
Follow up. So is there any reason that upon a successful confirmation on Wednesday that we should expect any sort of change in the amount of devotion and dedication that you've put into it?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. No, sir. This is my heart is in this. I'm with the staff. We want to make sure that we can take care of it. We want to make Alaska better for us having been here.
Yes, so follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
What about your executive team? Is your executive team, are they 48-hour a week crew? I mean, what can you tell us about the team that you surrounded yourself with?
Oh, through the chair, Representative Pruitt. This is a lot of work. This is 8,200-hour weeks, easy. Traveling back and forth, managing staff, different departments. And our executive team, I am truly, truly blessed to actually have the high level of dedication and work involved. There's a running joke in the office that if anybody can stay past longer than Tony Newman, then we win. Because he is there responding to legislators and constituent requests and media inquiries, working with our partners at the Department of Law. Just last night, we were all together meeting up until 7 o'clock at night. Finally realized, like, oh, well, I can stay in prep, but these guys should probably go home. But there was no complaints. They were there working with us.
And follow up, Madam Chair.
I would just comment that Tony Newman is well known for his incredible work ethic. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you.
Yes, he is. That's what kind of makes, I think, part of the conversation around the budget process unique, is you have legislators who do not have that type of experience that you've expressed even in the last 4 months of what you've learned as well as the team around you. Yet what always happens during budgetary process and what makes us unique from other states is that other states, you would be sitting here arguing for why you should spend the amount of money that we have given you. In this case, state of Alaska looks at you and says, you're going to spend what we tell you you're going to spend. So I guess the question I have is if we've told you that you're going to spend $100, but you figure out that you and your team, in the dedication and devotion that you've had, believe you can deliver the same services for $95, are you going to spend that $100 because the legislature told you to, or are you going to come back to us and say, no, $95 is all I need, and that's all I'm going to use?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, being a business owner, having a couple different companies, I know the value of a dollar, and I do not believe in surplus spending. What I do believe is, what is the strategy? If we can spend our dollars more efficiently, and there are better ways and actually other directions to spend that money, that's something to do this. Just for a single project, just because it has a list price, we're not going to spend that money on that. But if we can actually spend that towards something else that can actually improve outcomes, this is something that I would be very interested in. That's kind of the goal of our team.
And so one more follow-up, Madam Chair. One thing that I think is important, a lot of times we have these confirmation hearings, and the confirmation hearings focus mostly on the qualifications of the individual, maybe things that have recently happened before the confirmation takes place. What I don't hear a lot of times when we have these confirmation hearings is, in 4 years, whether it's the end of an administration or whether you're coming back looking to be reappointed to the same position, what do you expect to be able to tell us you've done successfully? What is your goal and your mission for the next 4 years and the role that you're in for this department?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, in taking over this role and understanding how important it is and where we sit as Alaska's a crossroads, long-term goal, what our team is working on, is how do we actually shift the dollar spend from one end of the spectrum to the other, moving towards that value-based side? One of the continued process with the 1115 waiver for behavioral health is going to actually allow us to spend dollars for mild and moderate issues as opposed to severe. And so we can work on things and provide assets and resources towards items like family resiliency, giving people and families opportunities to stay strong before we have to separate them, to put those resources out there, to make Alaska a stronger place that way and addressing issues on the front end. And this is something that it's going to take long term. I commend and recognize, but all my conversations with the members of the committee as well, this is something that's very nice because you recognize that as well. Because these are items that take longer to solve than an election cycle, and I do look forward to working with you on these issues. But these are the items that we're going to try to address.
All right. Next, we're going to go to Representative Tarr. She's decided she does have a question on the phone. She's all set. Go ahead, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and apologies, there was some earlier interference on the phone line. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Crum. Thanks for being with us. And I guess I have a question sort of about some of your more personal beliefs, because you were a political candidate yourself, and so some positions you've taken are known and, you know, were printed in literature, and some, for example, related to women's reproductive health. And I'm just wanting to hear how you're going to approach some of these issues. It's important to me that our policies are evidence-based and good public health policies and not ideologically driven. And I want to just hear from you sort of how you're going to uphold, you know, what I'm hoping you will do and in terms of women's reproductive health, LGBT issues, and not take an ideological position, even if that means it's inconsistent with your personal beliefs.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, thank you for that question. In this role, I took an oath. I had to sign an oath about I will follow the law, and that is what I will continue to do throughout this. As the courts have decided certain issues, that's the way that we will administer this through the department.
Do you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you. And I want to commend you. Thank you. I appreciate that answer, and I hope that's a firm commitment on that. I feel there may be more than just me who feel strongly about that. And earlier, you were talking about the volunteer work. I want to commend you for that. It's great, and I do hope that if you're confirmed to this position, it's, you know, the kind of connections you have in the community to go back and talk to people about what's really going on and understand the root causes. And there was just something you said that sort of struck me. You said about some of the kids you worked with at my house that, you know, they're the ones you really want to help. And I don't know if you intentionally meant this, but if you say something like that, it sort of suggests that there are some other ones that you don't want to help. And again, I hope that's not a position that would ever be put forward by the department, because as we know, and as we've recently done by putting a trauma-informed policy into statute, that many of the significant social and public health problems we have related to substance abuse and things are really linked back to, you know, other issues of childhood abuse and intergenerational trauma, institutional racism, and bad treatment over generations for different groups of people in Alaska. And so I don't know, again, if you meant that, but when I heard you say, you know, they're the ones you want to help, it makes me wonder if there's a group that you don't want to help, and I hope that would never be the position of the department.
Yours. Through the chair, Representative Tarr. Thank you for the chance to clarify that. All these people in need are ones that we need to help and show love and compassion for. I thank you for the distinction. I do appreciate the opportunity to clarify that. What I was getting at was when you sit across and you hear an individual tell you such a story that they recognize the need, they want to improve their lot in life, that's where you can't sit across with them and hear that and not want to help that individual. And so, yes, as a department, we are going to continue to take care of individuals throughout. So thank you.
Do you have a follow-up?
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I just appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Tarr?
No, not for now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure, since I can't make eye contact with you. I would like to remind people or mention people in the room that there is a public testimony sign-in sheet. I don't think that was available earlier, but it's available now. If you're interested, in next up in the queue is Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Crum, this is a little bit of a different scenario, but very different reality from my earlier questions, and it's a follow-up on Representative Tarr's question. So the House Finance Committee voted earlier this week that they would not include, I guess it was last week, they took a vote in which they removed funding for abortions in the Medicaid area. That's an area in which our Alaska Supreme Court has ruled at least twice that the department has to make those payments. So if the budget that came out of the House is the budget that finally passes and there's actually no specific funding in the budget to pay for abortions for people that are eligible for those services to be paid by Medicaid, what is your view of a department's obligation to pay those regardless of the absence of a line item?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman. Appreciate that question. It's a very contemplative question. As I said, we would follow the law and understanding that the court has ruled multiple times on this. I'd have to go back and look at the regulations. As some of the regulations within the department, as the issue with senior benefits, was that if there are no appropriations towards that, then you cannot pay out towards it. So I'd have to actually see if we have regulations to get that and how it matches with statute, sir.
Follow up. If the Attorney General were to tell you that you must pay them from whatever funds you have anywhere in the department and that the only way to change that obligation to pay would be a change in the Constitution, would you follow the Attorney General's advice?
I apologize. Through the chair, can you?
If the Attorney General told you that regardless of regulations and regardless of where the funds were coming from, but if the Attorney General told you that you had to pay them off regardless because that's what the Constitution requires and the only way to change that obligation would be to amend the Constitution, would you follow the Attorney General's advice?
Through the chair, Rep. Clement. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Representative, Co-Chair Zelkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in a follow-up to Representative Pruitt's question, can you talk, Mr. Crum, about your vision for the department over the next 4 years?
Through the chair, Rep. Sulkowski. As I was saying, we're trying to address these issues with flexibility. How can we actually take care of Alaskans in a much more Alaska-specific way? We have a very unique system. We have a very robust tribal health system that a lot of states aren't blessed to have. And so as we work with these groups, as well as our remote and rural communities, what can we do to provide much more specific issues, which that could be moving towards value-based care, working on social determinants of health, items such as that. Those are the items that we're trying to work towards.
Follow-up? Mm-hmm. Since January, the department has announced consideration of major policy changes, also somewhat related to the budget, including privatizing API, restructuring rates for Pioneer homes, potentially considering the elimination of senior benefits, and reductions to many programs that serve as a safety net for a lot of low-income Alaskans, like Medicaid. Can you talk about your role in the decision-making process in proposing these types of changes?
Through the chair, Rep. Sulkowski. As I had mentioned earlier, we had to put together a budget where expenditures match revenues. And some of those items that we had control over or the legislature had control over, which would be general fund, doesn't require federal match, those were put forth in either bills to be proposed for reduction in funding, and a lot of those items haven't moved forward. And so while we do a lot for a lot of people, we do have a lot of programs that we try to cover and take care of. This is a, it's a very difficult, this is not something we take lightly in order to do this, because we understand these are individuals and their time of need. But this was addressing the situation as a whole throughout the state, ma'am.
Follow-up. So I appreciate the difficult decision that you're in, and as Representative Pruitt mentioned, it's probably a lot more difficult on a day-to-day basis than many of us in this room have to deal with. And so we, I just want to take a moment to recognize that you have a tough job in front of you. So I guess just to drill down a bit more to make sure that I understand and clarify your response, you support the changes that have been proposed over the last several months as it relates to these programs because of the result to the budget?
Through the chair, Representative Zulkowski. We have to make tough decisions based upon the fiscal reality that we're in. While we do have a lot of social net items, some of the items presented in the budget, we're not going to leave dependents with zero. And so this was something that as we move forward, and it's the will of the legislature, some of these bills do not move forward, so those items will still be there, and we will gladly administer those programs.
Your follow-up? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crum, I can't remember what it's specifically called, but apparently the department has budget authority of excess budget authority of approximately $20 million. Mm-hmm. To transfer between programs as needed, because your department is large and has emergency issues that are not necessarily foreseeable by the legislature when the budget is established well in advance of your budget year. I'm very concerned about the inability to pay senior benefits to approximately 4,700 people for the months of May and June. With a little more than 2 weeks before those payments will be suspended. How much of that excess budget authority has been expended thus far in this fiscal year, and is there the roughly $750,000 remaining to cover those senior benefits? Those people need that money. And not giving to them isn't going to improve their situation, and I don't believe that your department can work fast enough to get alternative funding in place like SNAP or other benefits.
I apologize. Was there a question?
There is a question. But how much of that excess authority has
about
already
$20 million.
Been transferred among other programs, and is there enough remaining to pay the senior benefits for May and June?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, thank you for that. As I said earlier, this we actually shared this information out before regulation said we had to. We wanted to try and get in front of this so we could share this information with the public. We are working across the department trying to figure out, do we have funds available in order to do that, which is part of an ongoing analysis, so we can find out whether or not we're going to have this. We had a funding shortfall again for the general relief program as well, which required a wait list. So this is something that my ASD and their team, the Financial Management Services, they're trying to work through to see, can we actually address this? Because we do have the individuals and we know what tier and exact they're at, our eligibility techs are working as fast as possible to see if their individual case warrants increased SNAP benefits, which are 100% federal.
I still didn't hear an answer about what happened to that $20 million in excess authority.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, they're evaluating to see if there are funds available throughout the department to see if we can actually fill that. At this point in time, we don't have a clear answer.
So, Commissioner Crum, I'd like to follow up to that. I mean, I appreciate that you are making an effort to ensure that people are getting notice earlier. The earlier you can get notice of, you know, a change in your monthly income, the better, especially when we're talking about people that earn about, only have about $2,200 a month in income, which is not very much, particularly in some of our higher cost communities. You know, it creates a lot of stress, and I think unnecessary stress for seniors that don't have a lot of opportunity to add income Most the average age of people on senior benefits are 75. They go all the way up to 104, I think, is our oldest beneficiary. And so these aren't people that can necessarily, sometimes they can go out and get a job at Walmart, but probably they would already do that if they could. And not doing the homework to find out whether it's possible to find funding for that before you notify them seems, it concerns me, and it doesn't seem to me to be a very Christian or empathetic approach to public policy. As I read the statute, we pulled up the statute. The statute says you may reduce. It doesn't say you shall or that you must. Shall and must are the statutory ways that we tell you that you absolutely have to do something. May means you can. But we've already in earlier hearings, you heard from us and Ms. Eford heard from us about our concerns about eliminating the senior benefits program. And I guess I'm making some editorial comments right now, and I'll just pivot over to what's the rationale for ending the senior benefits program when, you know, the majority of people that are on that senior benefits program actually make a very small amount. The lower income levels for the senior benefit program, $942 a month. I'm just going to give that a moment to sink in. The middle level is $1,255 a month in income. And if you make that little amount, then you get $250 a month for the lower level, or $175 a month for the middle level. And these are the people that changed our diapers, that cared for us, that paid for our college educations, that took care of us when we needed it. And now they're at the lowest income level. You know, I don't understand the rationale for eliminating this program that in total only costs about $20 million, $25 million if we adequately fund it. Would you like to explain your rationale?
Madam Chair, as I said before, the senior benefits program is a statutory program. It's a straight general fund dollars. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the mechanisms we could to meet our budget goal. And as these individuals, if they lose income, they can have increased benefits elsewhere, which is throughout. And that was the rationale for that presenting that item.
So the budget goal was more important than making sure that people that only have $992 a month in income receive some assistance to help them pay with heating, prescriptions, and food, which is what we heard from people in testimony on the bill last year.
Madam Chair, I apologize. It's a very, very tough and not a fun position to be in. But as we address this, we do have a number of other programs that we actually help care for the senior community. If they needed that for heating assistance, there's other items they could actually apply for and move forward. And so it's not a fun situation. It's something that I know that it hasn't moved forward in the House item as well. So this is just one of those things that was unfortunate.
My experience when I was with the Salvation Army with the heating assistance program is that the funding for that has been decreasing over the years as well. And we often had people that came to us that we weren't able to give heating assistance funding to who were eligible for it because there just wasn't enough funding. So it concerns me to be relying on those other programs to provide assistance when we know that those programs are underfunded as well. And we've talked a little bit about the challenges that that you have as a commissioner trying to meet a budget goal. But I would argue you also have a mission goal, right? We've talked about mission-focused work, and that's the work that is done at the Salvation Army. That's the work that's done at my house. It's the work of making sure that people who need that care get it. And I think as the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, your absolute number one job is to make sure that you deliver on that mission. And I'm concerned that the budget is getting in the way of your ability to deliver on that mission.
Right.
Representative Zolkowski and then Representative Jackson.
As a follow-up to Representative Sponholt's question, I guess just to drill down a bit, in your role as commissioner, would you prioritize the mission of the department over budgetary, would you champion budgetary needs as you see them in order to adequately meet the needs of the mission of your department, or would you rather remain within the confines of your budget as proposed by the people around you, and instead consider cutting access to programs?
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski. As we presented cuts, we did make sure that we tried to diversify out across different groups, so that there was other safety nets available for those individuals. But in my role as commissioner, it is my job to manage the programs as best as possible with the budget that is provided to me.
Follow-up? Mm-hmm. So just to clarify then, in your role as commissioner, you would not evaluate the mission, prioritizing the mission necessarily, and trying to champion for leveraging funds and partnerships where you can. Instead, you would rather stay within the confines of the budget and cut programs from there.
Through the chair, Rep. Zolkowski, in order to manage as most effectively what the budget presented would actually dictate that I would need to leverage partnerships more to actually use more of those revenues and try to actually expand upon what available dollars there are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I don't hear an answer other than that you would stay within the confines of the budget and cut from there, but thank you.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you. Through the chair, so could you help me understand this senior program that we may not have funding May through June? Is that from decisions made from the last legislative session? Because we're still in the process of creating a budget now in this legislative session. So nothing's been cut yet because we're still in discussion of what will happen. So was that from something prior to this administration that sunset?
Through the chair, Representative Jackson. Yes, the available dollars that for the senior benefits program were the funds that were appropriated last year.
Thank you. My understanding is that you could request a supplemental. Would you be willing to request make a supplemental request to make sure that we could fully fund the senior benefits program this year? There's a second supplemental budget that will come through.
Through the chair. As we're going to continue and finish our evaluation process to see if that's necessary. If we actually have those funds, as Representative Drummond was getting at, do we have funds available interdepartmentally to transfer over or not? Mm-hmm. Then we'll come to that.
Great. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you. And I think since we're going to get into the budget conversation, then we should get into the budget conversation. We're going to reduce the dividend by $1,700. That's a lot more than we're talking about here for some of these seniors. But if we really want to get down this path, I don't think that really gets into the discussion about whether or not you're qualified to do the job here. So I want to bring it back to whether or not you're qualified to do the job. So let's talk about API just real quick. Was API a budgetary decision for you or a management decision for you?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. API was a management decision. We're actually going to have to invest more dollars into API in order to ensure patient care and safety as well as employee safety.
Follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we've spent a lot of time talking about what has happened since you've come into place. But I think it's important on that we kind of go back and look at this was a broken system from beforehand, and here you've walked into something that was incredibly messy, and somehow you've been taking heat for the actions that were taken from prior to you being here. So I appreciate indicating it's a management challenge. That's how I see it as well, not as a budgetary challenge. But going forward, and we've heard some really good things, it sounds like we're kind of turning a corner. We saw some additional, the recertification, I think that came out within the last day or two. Do you feel that, because I haven't had the chance to ask you, I've had the chance to ask some of your executive team in the committee setting, that even though the heat that you felt from that, and that this goes into your qualifications of leadership, if someone's looking at you, screaming at you about something, but you can still tell them that you made a decision you thought was the right decision, if someone were to come to you now and say, did you make the right decision on it, how would you respond to that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I absolutely stand by my decision on this. This was ultimately my decision in order to use my authority under statute Title 47. This is not something that was taken lightly. It was as a leader, I have the responsibility ultimately for the patient care at that hospital. And while we were working on some of those issues and trying to address long-term items, and to have a survey team on site and an immediate jeopardy be reported right there, that was more than I could accept at that point. It is my job to take care of those individuals. So we brought in a team in order to do that. And we have working towards stabilization stabilization at the facility. The nice thing is we've actually gone through retraining, through two full cycles of retraining, both in the what's called MANT training, which is the zero harm, trauma-informed care, and no restraint. And so as we're working towards the staff, getting them on that, rebuilding the culture there, putting a level of stability that we haven't seen. For years, API had the executive team turnover. They couldn't have any stability there, and we've got a little bit, and it's been nice to be recognized, particularly by the Joint Commission in their letter, where they said it was the evidence we submitted in March and then in April. They commended us by removing those efficiencies and recommended us for three full years of funding for Medicaid and Medicare.
All right, if we're going to talk about management and API, I'm going to go there. This has been no secret. You know, my concern about the selection of WellPath to run APIs is no secret. I really appreciate the amount of attention you've given API. I mean, frankly, API needed this much attention a year ago, right? We all know that it needed this much attention a year ago. I think the previous administration learned some mistakes. They learned them a little bit too late. Their budget request for API was similar to what you have requested for API with the budget amendment that was submitted. So it was $44 million. I appreciate the amount of attention that you're giving it. I think that it does matter because the folks that go to API, they are most vulnerable. They can't advocate for themselves. My concern is really about sort of the process that's been undertaken. WellPath, we took what was essentially an emergency situation and used that as the Trojan horse to get in the door to justify, you know, an over a five-year single source contract. That sort of, I think Representative Klayman has compared that to allowing the company that was within 3 miles of the Minnesota bypass the opportunity to bid on the Minnesota bypass repair after the earthquake in December and then award them the opportunity to do all of our maintenance in that area for the next 5 years. It's using a short-term crisis as a justification for, you know, a very major restructuring. We single-sourced, you know, we get a single source contract to a company that has a really dubious health and safety track record across the country. What knowledge did you have about WellPath's health and safety record prior to signing the contract?
Madam Chair, was well informed of WellPath's record. There's particularly their very good record in the states of Massachusetts and Florida. We actually talked with state health leaders in both Massachusetts and Florida and got glowing reviews about their ability to take over and transform what were once very violent, destitute hospitals. Working in the psychiatric field is a very litigious field. You're going to have lawsuits all the time, and the number of facilities that they manage, they're going to have a lot. API has a lot of standing lawsuits. Even Providence just got announced they're being sued last week mm-hmm. for psychiatric care, and that's not even their primary function. Mm-hmm. And so it's just one of those areas to where they do that. And so part of our due diligence is we reached out and actually talked to these leaders that had to do this, as well as the state oversight they still have over it. And so as we go down this process, they have a lot of key performance indicators they have to meet in order for this to continue on. And we're going to maintain it. We are not abdicating our responsibility as a state to care for these patients. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue to put dollars out the door to invest in this, as well as the increased government support as well. It's got a lot more teeth. And just this last week was fantastic. Abha's got a designated seat, so does Ashna, and a couple of these other groups.
I've been following that very closely, as you can imagine. So you mentioned performance metrics in the contract. What are the performance metrics?
It's the stabilization of the facility, maintaining of federal, federal accreditation mm-hmm. certification, as well as getting up to the point to where capacity is possible for full capacity, which anything to do with capacity related is a clinical decision. So these are the psychiatrists on staff. They make that determination based upon staff loads and what they are capable of handling. That is not something that management has any say over, is completely clinical.
Well, so I appreciate your describing those performance metrics. I have a master's degree in public administration, and one of the things that I studied was performance metrics, and knowing that you get what you measure, And that you need tools to be able to get out of a contract if somebody isn't performing to that standard. What you've described are sort of these one-time things that open up eligibility for phase two. What are the performance metrics that you're going to be looking at year in and year out to make sure that they're not just, you know, they're not just keeping the doors open and accredited, but they're actually making sure that patients are getting the care that they need?
Madam Chair, we'll continue to evaluate the standards of care to make sure. We are going to make sure that the community is involved, that us as a state are involved, because again, we are not abdicating our responsibility on this. We are going to make sure that those patients are taken care of and as we move forward. But in the contract, there actually is an out clause for us.
Mm-hmm. And what would the criteria be for the out clause?
Just if we wanted to, we could. We could break in service.
At any time?
I believe there's a notice in there, a certain amount of days.
I think there's like 30 days notice or something like that. But at any time, you could end it because you are not happy.
I believe it's, yes, ma'am.
Okay, and are we going to be doing the quality assurance, or are they going to be doing the quality assurance?
Part of the quality assurance program is tied into a lot of our accreditations, and so this will be something that we haven't decided fully if that's going to be on our side or their side, but the government's board will have to see those numbers as well.
I might suggest that you do the quality assurance so that we know that they're not cooking the books, because as recently as 2018, they were found to have, in Florida, actually have a hospital be understaffed and as a result have patients be harmed and somebody died. And I understand the fact that this is a litigious field, well past sites that, you know, 90% of the, you know, 1,100 lawsuits that have been described have been, you know, found not to be in order. But that means 110 were in order, and that there was findings in 110 of those lawsuits. And so it's pretty important to me that we be doing a really good job. And, you know, I would argue that the performance metrics you described are not actually terribly substantive when you're talking about a five-year contract to run our inpatient psychiatric institute. But I want to pivot over to block grants now. You know, we've been really successful in redesigning our Medicaid system. You know, Heather Carpenter is on your team. I'm sure she's, you know, briefed you fully on that work. You know, as Co-Chair Zelkowski was referencing earlier, we now serve 63% more people. That's 79,000 more people than we did 4 years ago, and we do it for 11% less in state spending. I mean, that's a big achievement. I'm proud of that as a state, and that spending has been important to us as we've sort of gone through our recession. You're proposing that we move to block grants and that Alaska be the first state in the nation to do that. And historically, block grants have not worked very well for large, geographically large but small population states. Do you have any hesitation at all about Alaska playing the role of guinea pig as it relates to being the first in the nation to do block grants?
Madam Chair, currently there is no mechanism for the federal government to provide block grants for Medicaid.
Okay, so it's just an idea?
Madam Chair, the idea on that was to let them know that we wanted to be out in front, whatever these solutions were. And there were some statements from me that were in the media, and that the last line always gets cut off. Because we did that ask, we are actually now working on any other possible solutions, working very closely with CMS and our federal delegation, trying to figure out what are other ideas we can have for Alaska. And it was a foot in the door, let us be first on something. We need an Alaska-specific solution.
So are you saying you're not pursuing block grants?
Such an option come available from CMS, that's something we will have to give due consideration, but at this point in time, that is not our main plan, ma'am.
It's not our main plan. That wasn't really an answer to the question.
Follow-up.
Co-Chair Zelkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a follow-up to the issue of block grants, there's been a concerted effort, you know, when it comes to state government, the mission of the work that we do is highly embedded and endemic within the budget that we pass. That's the way that we as legislators and we as state leaders talk about the values that we support and the programs that we support. And there has been a concerted effort recognizing that HESS has one of the largest budgets and is a budget driver for the state of Alaska to evaluate where are their cost savings. And so as Representative Sponholz mentioned, the governor had made a statement to the president supporting Medicaid block grant models. What we know about block grants is that funding levels are fixed, meaning that the program is rendered unable to automatically respond to any sort of increased need, particularly in times of recession or economic downturns. This also means that a block grant cannot respond the same way to a faltering economy or greater need throughout our communities, essentially destabilizing the economy over time and worsening the downturn. It makes it difficult for particularly Americans, but also Alaskans, to be able to get into the workforce or remain in the workforce because potentially of their health conditions, and ultimately could increase government costs over time because it's pushing people who don't have care into emergency rooms across the state, pushing up uncompensated care costs. We've seen reductions of that through Medicaid expansion and having increased Alaskans having access to affordable health care coverage. In contrast, when a program is built to respond to meet community need and eligible individuals can access programs without delay, for example, in the way that our Medicaid system currently is structured, versus standing firm on ideological issues around cost containment, the economy can be stabilized and fewer people over time qualify for benefits. So I guess I would ask if the department under your leadership would champion the model of block grants when it's been proven that block grants over time are not a sound policy decision in terms of long-term sustainable cost savings, or would you consider remaining in the same type of Medicaid model that we currently have, which would be much more responsive to the needs of Alaskans and likely have cost savings over time with increased investments from the federal government?
Madam Chair, through the chair, to Representative Zolkowski. Thank you for that question, and that I appreciate all the data. If you present items like that, it makes block grants not seem feasible. As I said, we have not gone down this road about whether or not we've considered the long-term feasibility, and as we do this, it will require consideration on our end as well. So the ideas that we want to pursue are any options that give us the flexibility to address a lot more issues in Alaska as well. And so we want to make sure that we can drive dollars towards the local side in dealing with mild and moderate as opposed to severe issues. So as we continue down this path, we'll definitely be in touch.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So can you then speak to your level of participation as one of the governor's closest advisors, potentially to, you know, serving in these last several months in his cabinet? How involved were you in the decision to ask President Trump to lean into a Medicaid block grant model?
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski. It's gotten a lot of attention, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it showed that Alaska wants to be on the front side. And so we've actually determined and driven a lot of conversations that way. So how can we actually do this on Alaska-specific model? And that was the driving intent of that, was to put us out in front, that put them on notice that we want to be first. And so any new considerations or guidance they have, we'd like to be a part of that discussion.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So you were actively involved in suggesting to the governor to suggest to President Trump that Alaska is interested in Medicaid block grants?
Madam Chair?
Yes or no would suffice?
No.
Thank you. Follow up?
Sure.
Stepping back to the issues around API, Deputy Commissioner Wall had appeared before Senate Health and Social Services regarding the no-bid contract with WellPath, and when asked whether the department would reconsider pursuing a competitive bid process, given in Providence Hospital's interest in competing for a contract, Mr. Wall said that the decision would be up to the commissioner. So I ask you, as the commissioner, will you be issuing a competitive RFP for phase two or for the long-term management of API?
Through the chair, Representative Zolkowski. Actually, that decision currently lies with the chief procurement officer.
And would you be encouraging the chief procurement officer to pursue that?
Madam Chair, we're continuing our discussions as we look at the API. It's an ever-evolving situation that has our attention.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So the direct quote from Senate Hess was that, from your deputy commissioner, was that the contract with WellPath and decisions regarding moving forward with other providers would have to be taken into consideration by the commissioner's office. So I guess I would ask for some follow-up from the department on the plans moving forward and what the plan of action will be, given that there are nonprofit Alaska-based providers that have expressed interest in competitively bidding for the long-term management of that facility.
All right. So I have a question about PFAS. Given your background in environmental health and safety, I was a little surprised to learn that for quite some time the health department has had a pretty clear statement about PFAS, saying that the sum concentration of the five PFAS of concern in your drinking water is above, if it is above, the DEC action level of 70 parts per trillion, then immediately stop drinking the water and stop using it to prepare baby formula, and that has now been updated, and we have removed the specific language referencing the DEC standard of 70 parts per trillion. You want to do you have an explanation for that? I was surprised because this is such a big issue in our state right now.
Madam Chair, yes, so we as a state actually decided to follow the EPA health advisory guidance of 70 parts per trillion for the sum of two for PFAS contaminants. And so that is because the EPA is pushing towards that guidance as we look towards this. It's an emerging issue. They're trying to do long-term studies. The CDC and the Toxic Substances Disease Registry, they're actually going to do long-term longitudinal studies at eight sites around the United States, health effects, long-term studies, health records, trying to figure this out because there is no concrete determined levels across the board. There's a lot of states throughout the country who have certain standards, but they all vary. And so we figured because Alaska, where we're standing at, it was best for us. We're going to tie ourselves to the current EPA standard.
And the EPA standard is 70 parts per trillion?
For the sum of two.
Okay. How come we took that information out of the statement on our public health website?
I'll have to check that, madam, for that guidance. I'll make
sure
that.
There's been some reporting on this that previously it said very clearly in there what the standard was, and that section of the sentence that described what the standard was has been removed, which is a little bit concerning from a public health standpoint.
We will take care of that. Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Thank you. All right. Are there any other questions for Commissioner Designee Crum?
I have a question.
All right. One more. Co-Chair Zlokowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we have been asking a lot of questions about leadership rationale, ultimately, because the role that you've assumed is protecting access to some really critical programs for a lot of really vulnerable Alaskans. And so as you manage these issues, the budget is, of course, tied to that. The administration had recommended eliminating the hold harmless provision as it relates to the permanent fund and individuals on public assistance. And we know that the elimination of this program does not save general fund dollars and serves as a critical safety net for low-income Alaskans who, for a short period of time after receiving their permanent fund, are bumped out of eligibility. Can you talk about what your participation was in suggesting that as an opportunity to cut the program? Were you involved in suggesting that Alaska eliminate the hold harmless provision?
Through the Chair, Rep. Zlokowski. Through that budget process was a lot of many late nights, hours in groups as a committee addressing items we can do. This is not necessarily a general fund issue. It comes directly from the permanent fund. Or where those dollars come from. And in order for that to go away, there would actually have to be a bill, which I don't believe has been presented at all. Is that correct?
You would know. I would hope.
I don't believe it's moved through that process.
I'm not introducing a bill,
yeah.
Commissioner Crum.
So yeah, that's where we stand on that, ma'am.
Follow up. So do you support the recognizing that the hold harmless provision does not save general fund dollars? Do you support eliminating the hold harmless provision program and potentially exposing Alaskans to being at risk of losing benefits that they otherwise would qualify for?
Through the Chair, Rep. Zlokowski, if given, as Lance, as Representative Pruitt had pointed out, if the full dividend was paid out, this would actually more than mitigate that coverage.
I'm sorry, I don't believe I heard a yes or no to that, whether you support the elimination of that program.
Yes, through the Chair, yes.
Yes, you do support elimination of hold harmless. Can you speak into the mic for your response?
Through the Chair, Rep. Zlokowski, yes.
Thank you.
All right.
Yep, Madam Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, and I think it's just important to highlight that that's around $43 per permanent fund that we're paying for that hold harmless. And yet, instead of having a different discussion about maybe going to a quarterly payout or something else, I think we just seem to be centrally focused. And again, I think it probably doesn't necessarily speak to the qualifications of the individual that's in front of us. It's more of a budgetary conversation. We should have that. I think he's demonstrated very well his understanding of the issues, and maybe that's where we should keep our comments and our questions.
All right. So I have a question. One of the things that you did early on in the API process was you exerted emergency authority over API, which confused me a little bit, because as Commissioner of Health and Social Services, you already have authority over API. You're the ultimate sort of arbiter as it relates to API. What new tools did that give you in the toolbox?
Madam Chair, what happened with API was, as a licensed health facility in the state of Alaska, mm-hmm. there's a statute that says the department, the commissioner, can assume control of any licensed health facility, either temporarily or permanently, and insert their own management. And that was the tool that was used.
Follow-up, I guess I'm a little confused, because as the commissioner, you already have that authority. My understanding is that that authority was created to allow the commissioner to assume authority over a private hospital that wasn't, you know, living up to the standards of care that are necessary in the state of Alaska. But as the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, you would already have that authority within your framework, because API is a public institution and the director of API reports to you, fundamentally.
Madam Chair, the decision to use that statutory authority was in conjunction with our partners at Department of Law.
So Department of Law recommended it. Mm-hmm. And are you clear on what additional tools they gave you?
It elevated this to the level to where we understood exactly what was going on, and it made it a public issue, so we knew how we're going to take care of it.
Okay. I'm still not certain why it is that that was needed, but you're saying that the Department of Law told you that you needed to do that. All right. Thank you. Is there any other questions for Commissioner Crum before we thank him for his time and move on to public testimony?
One more.
Oh, all right. Co-Chair Slokowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one more. I know that we've talked, Commissioner Designee Crum, informally, not in committee, about the efforts of the department in approaching CMS for approval as it relates to proposed Medicaid cuts. Can you talk a little bit about, can you describe in detail what efforts the department has been making since January as it relates to seeking CMS approval for Medicaid cuts?
Through the chair, Representative Kosky, I'm not comfortable actually addressing it at this time. We're waiting on some extra guidance, and that will help determine the direction as we've been working on.
Extra guidance. Follow up. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, we understand the approval process that needs to happen, and CMS may not ultimately approve what the department is potentially proposing or considering, and maybe sounds, I guess state government seems like it should be a public and transparent process, and would hope that you would feel comfortable in working with your legislative bodies to talk about it. But how do you anticipate, if CMS doesn't approve the proposed cuts, how that would impact Alaska's Medicaid program?
Through the chair, Rep. Sikorski, are you referring to the phase one cuts for Medicaid?
I'm referring to CMS rate reductions.
Through the chair, Rep. Sikorski, yes, we are working with CMS on that for those items. I apologize. I thought you were referring to the phase two process.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. And so if CMS doesn't approve those reductions, and ultimately we would be required to pay more than what was budgeted, are you with intention to come back to the legislature next year for a supplemental?
Through the chair, Rep. Sikorski, if that is the case, then yes, we would have to do so.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Co-Chair Zelkowski's question triggered a question that I meant to ask earlier. In the original proposal for Tier 1 rate reductions, you know, you carved out community access hospitals and primary care providers amongst those that were carved out. Given that we have just barely completed the rebasing of behavioral health rates, and that we have a substance abuse, you know, sort of challenge that our state is facing, are you prepared to potentially carve out, if there's funding available, to carve out also behavioral health providers from the rate reductions and the inflation withholding?
Madam Chair, as we evaluate this process, we've been talking with APHA about this as well. Mm-hmm. As the 1115 SUD waiver comes in action as well, we're going to evaluate and work with our partner groups to see if there is funding available, if you appropriate as such, mm-hmm. then, yeah, we'll continue down that road to make sure it's funded.
I think that's good. I think that's wise. I mean, one of the things that, you know, behavioral health providers, going back to my Salvation Army experience where we ran Clithro, we were told as the department moved from grants over to Medicaid funding that we just needed to kind of hold on. It was going to be a little while, but, you know, just hold tight. We're going to get there. And it took a while for that transition to happen. And the part of the problem in that transition was that the Medicaid rates weren't adequate to actually cover the amount of cost of delivering service. And as you well know about the Salvation Army, this is not an organization that is, you know, flush with overhead and things like this. This is a bare bones budget operation. And we struggled to make our operation at Clitheroe, for example, just continue to pencil out. And my job as the Director of Development and Communications was to backfill and make sure that we could keep the doors open. And so we went through the rebasing process that we just barely finished. And then providers heard that there was going to be a rate reduction when we hadn't even seen the results of the rebasing go into effect, which made it difficult for people to understand how it is we were going to get to the other end of our healthcare system, our behavioral healthcare system redesign. So it gives me some comfort that you say that you're willing to protect them should we make sure there's funding. So thank you very much. And with that, thank you for your generosity of time this afternoon. We're gonna have public testimony today. We'll continue to have public testimony on Tuesday afternoon, and would love to have you join us then as well if you're available. Thank you. All right. And with that, we're going to go ahead and open up the confirmation hearing for public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? Let's see. I don't have the sign-up sheet, Ted. All right. Looks like first up we have Allison Curry. And next up is Jane Andreen after that.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Allison Curry. I am the legislative liaison for Planned Parenthood Votes here in Alaska and also a Juneau resident. Planned Parenthood does oppose the nomination of Adam Crum to this position. We feel he lacks experience with healthcare policy, delivering health and social services, and then his ideology is also fundamentally at odds with the department's mission. During Mr. Crum's campaign for state senate in 2016, he ran on a platform of cutting access to government programs and restricting a woman's constitutional right to make decisions about her own body. And anti-abortion activists are supporting his nomination for this very reason. In a November 2018 article with Alaska Public Media, a representative from Alaska Right to Life, which opposes all abortion, noted that they endorsed him in his run for state senate because of his commitment to ending abortion. They also noted their hope that he could make an impact on ending abortion in his role at DHSS. The department oversees access to healthcare services, including abortion care, for people with low incomes in our state. And we recognize that everybody has a variety of opinions on abortion, and we respect other people's views, but feel that someone who is fundamentally opposed to those services should not be in charge of controlling access to those same services. Also, Alaska needs a leader who will implement proven and effective strategies for improving public health and decreasing health disparities across communities. Our state, as you all know, has some of the highest rates of suicide, domestic violence, sexual assault, and sexually transmitted infections in the nation. We need a commissioner who has the experience necessary to tackle these challenges and advance bold solutions that will improve the health of all Alaskans across the state, especially historically marginalized communities who are more likely to already lack access to health care and social services. So far, the ideas presented to the legislature by the department to contain Medicaid costs would not accomplish these goals. They would further exacerbate the public health problems communities are currently facing. We need a commissioner we can count on to promote healthy communities and families without limiting access to care. Between the presentations we've seen in numerous committees by department staff and the commissioner designee's noticeable absence from many of them, we are not confident that Mr. Crum is the best fit for this position and ask that you reject his nomination. Thank you very much for your consideration of these comments and for the opportunity to testify today.
All right, thank you for your testimony. All right, next up we have Jane Andreen.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Jane Andreen. I live in Douglas, and I'm here testifying as myself. I come before you as someone who has worked in Alaska for the last 37 years in health and human services. I've worked at both the private and the public sector. I've worked in leadership roles up within the state. I've also served as a national trainer for a health policy curriculum that was developed out of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, from the year 2009 to 2017. And as such, I have trained hundreds of human and health service providers on how to do public policy, all the way from determining when policy is needed to analyzing policy to when it will best meet the needs of whatever the group is looking at to implementation and evaluation. And that's where I bring my main concern. I have not met Mr. Crum. This is the closest I've been to him. I hear he's really a nice guy, and I appreciate that. Also, I just found out he's from Anchor Point, and I lived in Homer.
Oh, wow. For 15 years.
So I think that's kind of, it's nice to be connected that way. But what my concerns are is his lack of experience, particularly in the areas of health policy, health and human service policy, how you go about doing that. I feel that that's one of the most critical components of being a commissioner. You have to have good management skills. You have to have good people skills. You have to understand and know how to effectively implement policy. He has gone on the record saying he's not a health policy guy, type of guy. I'm concerned looking at the number of very significant policies that have come out of the administration and the Department of Health and Social Services, and you folks have talked with him about several of those. Just to give an example, one of the issues that I've been very concerned about over the last several years is senior benefits and maintaining that program for some of our most vulnerable elders. What I heard today is that the driving force with most of the policies that have come out has been based on the budget, the need to cut the budget. And what we have to be looking at, what I'm concerned he may not bring to the table, is the ability to look at who this is going to impact, how it's going to impact them, in what ways can we mitigate that, in what ways can we work around it. I've sat in hearings this last week, two hearings on the senior benefits program, with his staff sitting there saying they didn't know what the impact of eliminating the program would be on many of the people in the program. That concerns me. They say it's very complex, and they keep saying, well, they could get food stamps. There might be other programs that could help them, but they couldn't give concrete numbers, and they don't know. That's the kind of information that has to be assessed and gathered up front before a policy is put into place or even proposed. We have 4,700 people in the state right now who are very concerned about losing 2 months' worth of stipends, and that's a stress I don't think that they should have to deal with. I also am concerned that in over $3 billion budget, they don't know if they can find $800,000 to fill that gap. One of the things that I do believe is happening is that much of these policies that the department has been working on and implementing are not necessarily coming from his leadership, but are coming from the governor's office. And I heard him say, and understand that this is the reality, that as commissioner, he takes his marching orders from the governor. That's very true. But one of the focuses, one of the responsibilities of a good commissioner is to be able to come back to the governor and say, I understand this is what you want. Here's what our analysis shows. Here's what our options are. Here's what the evidence is. Here's what the data tells us. To help the governor make decisions that are going to be in the best interest of Alaskans' health and well-being. As I said, I've heard he's a really nice guy. I think that he has excellent educational credentials, but I'm not sure that he has the qualities that we most specifically need for this position. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Now, next we're going to go to the OFNET and first go to Tanya Halliday. Am I saying that correctly, Ms. Halliday?
Yes, I think so.
Thank you. All right, go ahead. Put your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Tanya Halliday. I work at Cook Inlet Dental in Kenai, Alaska, and I would like to suggest that we vote no on Crum. Commissioner designee Adam Crum does not possess the knowledge or experience to run the largest and most complicated agency in the state, and that by his own admission, he is not a health policy guy. His retooling of how we collectively care for our most vulnerable Alaskans has led to crises at API and the Pioneer Homes. His health policies driven by strategies that drive efficiencies and cost savings within the system have led us to a $100 million a month contract with WellPath and huge cost increases at Pioneer Homes, for residents. Since CRUM has taken over DHHS, there is an alarming trend of delayed and slow payments to providers and another of only paying care coordinators once per month. While waiting until the last moment to pay the claim or deny claims, they are shifting the cost to providers at the detriment of their livelihoods. Also, by increasing the pre-authorization process, it affects recipients' ability to seek timely care and hamstrings providers' ability to provide that care. Medicaid block grants don't work and will do more harm than good. What atrocities will he have in store for Children's Services, Juvenile Justice, Senior and Disability Service, and Public Assistance when he believes getting people off of state-paid health care and into sustainable jobs will be a priority? Not everyone receiving state services are employable, which is why many are receiving state services. His strategy to cut and gut behavioral health, including defunding the Suicide Prevention Council, is horrific. Please do us all a favor and vote no on CROM.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Next up, we have Elizabeth Ripley.
Thank you.
Ms. Ripley, are you still there? All right, you might have us on mute. I'll give you one more second. All right, next we're going to go to Michelle Overstreet. Ms. Overstreet?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, there we go. You want to put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony?
I do. This is Michelle Overstreet. I'm the founder and executive director for a nonprofit in the Mapview Valley called My House. And I would encourage the committee to vote in favor of approval for Adam Crum. He has been a mentor and a volunteer, an advisory board member for our organization just about since its founding, and I feel like Adam does have the qualifications that would be needed. I understand some of the concerns that have been expressed around policy, but frankly, when we have the highest rates of domestic violence, suicide, child sexual abuse, sexual assault in the nation, it's time for a fresh set of ideas, and creative and innovative leaders are welcomed, and we know Adam to be that from our work with him. I also want to speak to his integrity level. I think you heard him answer all the questions that were posed, and there were some very challenging questions today in this hearing. He answered with integrity, and that is his character. We have had experience with Adam in an advisory capacity, not only for the youth that we serve, many of whom are marginalized and really left by the wayside in many circumstances. He has without a doubt included all those marginalized groups with the youth that we serve. There was no discrimination, and his concern is for the betterment of the youth and the betterment of Alaska. That isn't to say that he would exclude other groups like seniors or those with other kinds of disabilities, but it is speaking to his character and his commitment to increasing access to services and empowering people to become the best that they can be as Alaskans. I also heard a lot of what sounded like reading from written statements from different organizations. While I can appreciate that, we are an organization that has utilized public health in our building. We utilize a lot of the same philosophies and strategies that Planned Parenthood does. I've never ever had Adam be negative about those, particularly with the demographic that we serve. So I think if you get on the ground with him and have real life conversations with him, I think that this is a person who has the ability to turn the tide for a lot of things that we've been trying to change in Alaska for a long time. And I would urge the committee to offer him the utmost support to be able to do that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Overstreet, and keep up the good work out there at my house. All right. Next up, we have Xenia Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Xenia Peterson. I live in Senate District I, and I'm representing myself. Today, I'm testifying against the nomination of Adam Crum for the position of a commissioner to the Department of Health and Social Services. Although Mr. Crum has experience in running a business in Alaska, he has never worked in a health-related field, nor does he have background in working with public policy. I'm definitely concerned about this because due to his primary job of overseeing numerous health departments. And as was previously mentioned, it should also be concerned to the committee as well as to the Department of Health and Social Services. When looking at Mr. Crum's past statements on the size of our government and talks about reducing the government budget, I worry that his initiative will put people out of jobs and cut funding to the healthcare services that many Alaskans rely on. And additionally, I have concerns about Mr. Crum's ties to life, to the Alaska Right to Life group, his past statements on women's receiving basic health care services. My fear is that when the time comes, Mr. Crum will make a decision on women's right to choose that is based on his personal ideology, especially of his ties to Alaska Right to Life, instead of thinking about a woman's right to choose in the state of Alaska. And as a woman living here, I worry about my constitutional and health rights being taken away from me because of somebody else's agenda and priorities. So I would like to thank the committee for letting me testify, and I encourage all of you to reject the nomination of Adam Crum. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Peterson. All right. I believe that we have Elizabeth Ripley back on the line. Ms. Ripley? I wonder if you have us on mute. Ms. Ripley? All right. Moving on to Shelley Ebenall.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Shelley Ebenall. I am the Executive Director and General Counsel for the Greater Fairbanks Community Hospital Foundation and the CEO for Foundation Health Partners. Foundation Health Partners offers a full continuum of healthcare services in interior Northern Alaska residents. Our services include Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, 152-bed facility with dual designation by CMS as a sole community hospital and a rural referral center. We also have Tanana Valley Clinic with 54 physicians that provide access to Medicare and Medicaid patients, and Denali Center, which is our long-term care facility connected to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. I'm here today to ask for your support in the confirmation of Commissioner Designee Adam Crum. During his first few months on the job, the Foundation Health Partners Board invited Commissioner Designee Crum to Fairbanks in January at 30 below, and he accepted. Since that first meeting, Designee Crum has made himself available to us on several occasions, continued dialogue about existing needs and services in the interior. His door's always been open, and he's always been able to sit down and approach problems with us in a reasonable manner. Commissioner Crum spent the entire afternoon with the board, listening intently, asking great questions about our operations, our programs, and our services that we provided. He not only asked great questions, they were the right questions. What's working, what's not working, how can we work together? It's fair to say that the attending FHP staff and board members found Commissioner Crum to be engaging, earnest, quick study, intelligent, and most importantly, solution-oriented. The respect and appreciation he's extended to us has in providing our healthcare delivery system is refreshing. For being on the job only a little more than 3 months, it appears to us that he's committed to gain the knowledge necessary to address the issues facing the department. We at FHP understand the state's challenging budget constraints and the stress this is putting on the state. We appreciate the commissioner's difficult task in identifying ways to reduce the costs while maintaining services for Alaska. We stand ready and continue to work with the department and Commissioner Crum to identify solutions to problems facing Alaska's healthcare delivery system, and we encourage you to support his confirmation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony today. All right. We are going to try Elizabeth Ripley for the third time. Ms. Ripley, do we have you?
My apologies.
All right. There we go. So good to hear your voice. Why don't you put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you. Representative Spanholz, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Ripley, and I serve as CEO of the Matsu Health Foundation, which shares ownership in Matsu Regional Medical Center. I'm here to support the nomination of Adam Crum as Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. I first met Adam at the Matsu Business Alliance, where he and his family's business, Northern Industrial Training, have won multiple awards for growing their business and helping the Matsu economy. Since then, I've had the
Ms. Ripley?
Been impressed with how
we lost you for a second there. You might want to back up a sentence.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I've had the opportunity to interact with Adam in his new role as commissioner, and I've been impressed with how quickly he has come to understand the department, Alaska's healthcare needs and challenges, and the complicated funding streams, systems, and statutes that drive healthcare delivery in Alaska. He's expressed genuine appreciation and support for DHSS staff for their efforts to improve our healthcare, and he's trying to help the divisions break down silos and be more strategic, efficient, and effective. I believe that Adam has a heart for this work, and that coupled with his business acumen will go a long ways toward making his tenure successful. He's trying to negotiate a path forward with CMS to meet the governor's goal of reducing healthcare costs to the state and reducing healthcare costs for Alaskans. That is something we can all get behind. He knows Alaska has behavioral health challenges, including an opioid crisis. He recognizes the need to shift investments to prevention and early intervention. He grasps the benefits of maximizing investments in home and community-based services. And he understands we're counting on him and his leadership to figure out how to make these shifts get more value and better health outcomes for Alaskans from our healthcare delivery system. We do have some concerns about changes to Medicaid that have been put forward by the administration, but we feel like our concerns are being heard by Adam. Our position has always been that Medicaid reform offers opportunities for efficiencies that must be explored. We've expressed to the department that behavioral health and home and community-based service providers should be excluded from the proposed provider rate cut. These providers to a Medicaid billing model must be accomplished over several years' time for critical services to be sustained for Alaskans. We've also discussed how private sector investment in our community to build out behavioral health services and long-term services and support is dependent in part on a stable Medicaid environment. We need someone at the helm of DHSS who has the business acumen, the finance and budgetary skills, the Lean Six Sigma organizational management knowledge, the workforce development expertise, and the communication and emotional intelligence to lead change. Adam has those skills and experiences. I recommend him, and I look forward to partnering with DHSS to deliver more value for our health and social services dollars. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you for your testimony today, Ms. Ripley. All right, next up we have Greg Weaver. Delay.
Hello, I am calling today because I've been watching this affair on TV for a few hours, and I'm calling to oppose Mr. Crum. I appreciate some of your direct questions. There was a lot of indirect answers and answers that frankly went nowhere, and he was asked many times whether that was a yes or a no. I first met Adam Crum over a dozen years ago when I was employed at his family's truck driving school there, NOT, and I witnessed a lot of things I wasn't happy with. But I'm a fairly good judge of character, and I saw things I didn't like with students and instructors, but that is not the issue. Not only do I believe that he doesn't have the character or any leadership qualities, I haven't seen any accomplishments in his life or any government experience, and I'm frustrated that this has even got to this point, but I am definitely urging a no on this confirmation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony today, Mr. Weaver. All right, next up we have Casey Black from Dillingham.
Hello, this is Casey DeShock testifying on behalf of myself, and I would urge a yes vote on Crum for the commissioner position. I happened to stumble across this testimony as I was turning on the television for my family. I know that our and probably likely many LIO offices in rural Alaska are currently not open for the day, and so you would have to call Juno in order to get the number. I do believe that the question in front of this committee is whether or not the man that you are getting ready to confirm is qualified for the position. It is not. It does not have anything to do with whether or not you agree with his policies or whether or not you agree with the direction that he wants to take the department. The person before you ready to be confirmed is somebody who has experience managing a large group of people and a disparate number of competing requirements, which is what his position will require. I do believe that many of the questions have been leading and that many of the questions have given him no choice, even though they've been yes or no questions. The answer has been terrible, whether he answers yes or no. So I would just caution the committee to look at whether or not the person that you're looking at, whether or not you're evaluating him on his ability or whether or not you're evaluating him on his policies, because given the qualifications or given in some of the testimony that's come to him, you would not be able to support any change to education because the governor himself is an educator. So you would have to support the governor in his education cuts. I'm not sure that you guys are willing to take that step. And so you shouldn't hold this commissioner responsible for being a doctor or being somebody that has a long-term experience in the health field. What you need to look at is whether or not this person is able to manage this department. And I do believe that Adam Crum is a very qualified person to manage this department. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I think we may have a difference of agreement on what the importance of the committee's questioning is. I think when you're running an organization that's a $3.4 billion organization, it's fair game to have a conversation about the policies in order to demonstrate whether or not the applicant has the chops and has done the work to demonstrate their readiness for the job. And this committee takes its responsibility to vet this candidate very seriously because it is so important. So with that, we're going to hold open public testimony on this confirmation. We've gone a little bit over time today. We'll take additional testimony on Tuesday's hearing, which will be at 3 p.m. for those of you that are listening. Next up on Tuesday, we'll have second hearings on House Bill 89 and 114, and we'll look to the will of the committee on those pieces of legislation. We also ask if you have amendments to those bills, please get those to the committee aides by the close of business on Monday. Also on Tuesday, we will be hearing from the two remaining appointees to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. That's Ken McCarty and John Sturgeon. Finally, we will finish up the confirmation hearing of Commissioner Designee Crum. And on Thursday, we'll have initial hearings on House Bill 96 by Representative Fields and Senate Bill 37 by Senate President Giesel. The time is looks like 3:38, and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned. Mm-hmm.